So where the fuck are you?
I am literally looking. I am in a canyon. I'm on the top of the east side of a canyon that is bisected by the Grande, I think, the Grande River. So I'm in Carson National Forest in northern New Mexico, nearest Cuesta, New Mexico.
Was this a planned trip? Because I feel like last week I didn't know you were going to New Mexico.
No. This was not only planned, but we then had another conversation afterward that Heaton was going to spend the previous 3 days of camping soft scouting for this particular moment. And considering the remote environs that he has traversed, I would say success, Heaton. You have both a phone connection and an internet connection.
This is all correct.
You just don't have headphones.
This is all, yeah, I forgot the headphone or the extra headphones. Although, again, it doesn't seem to be showing up on my waveform, so I don't think it'll be an issue. I had planned to go camping in a much less slapdash manner, Jen, in about 3 weeks. However, Wallace's radiologist informs me that we're going to be doing 15 days of radiation treatment. And so the only time that I could go camping would be now. And so I kind of in 3 days decided to just jettison and have been camping. Wallace is super worn out. He's in the camper right now. We usually my pedometer says that I hike like I walk like 8,000 steps a day. I think the last 2 days I've walked over 30,000 steps. I don't know how many miles that is, but I finally wore out the dog. Anyway, wow. So I'm out in the middle of no fucking nowhere to get to the campground I'm at. I had to drive like at 15 miles an hour for 35 minutes through a bunch of Bureau of Land Management land. I am the only person in this park. No one else is here. But it's absolutely beautiful and just wondrous. And Justin, you're correct. Yes, I've been scouting out locations that I could conceivably have a conversation in. I started out in a really pretty area of Carson National Forest just north of Red River a couple of days ago. But the cell phone reception was very spotty, and even text messages were intermittent. And so last night and today, I've been checking the internet speed. It seems to be sufficient. I'm also about 45 minutes from a town, so had there not been sufficient internet speed, I was going to decouple my car and drive in, but I think we're okay.
Excellent.
Well, this is the kind of hustle that we give to you, the listener, that we strive. Now, it's your, right now I'm looking at Jen lounging on a couch somewhere in Seattle. And yes, I've adjusted my hue lights so my cheekbones pop and I look appropriately attractive to everybody else on the riverside. But Heaton is glamping and had to find cell reception because you, the listener, need the podcast each and every week. That's our commitment.
This is how fucking committed I am to you. I am on my annual camping trip vacation where I don't fucking think about anything. And I just wander the hills with my dog. And in the middle of it, I have dropped everything and prepared to stop the trip and drive to a Enron gas station in Cuesta, New Mexico, if all of this stuff hadn't worked out. But I'm here. I'm here, goddammit.
You're here. You're here, and I'm going to make you talk about sports, which is even funnier that I'm ruining your vacation on that level.
Honestly, I'm going to have a lot more to say about the charter schools, but I'll give it a shot on the sports.
We're going to be able to make it work. Jen, you are in the Pacific Northwest still, right?
Yes, I am currently a basement troll in my in-laws' house in Seattle. And I go to Mexico City in the morning. So we're getting ready for that. Yeah, I'm super excited. And yeah, so last day as a troll.
For the record, we did not read this. I didn't put it in the email, but I do want to mention it. There was a correction that I do want to issue from last week's show where we were joking about the Chaz and the Chop, the anarchists-led areas of Seattle during the George Floyd protests of a few years ago. And we made a joke that somebody was shot and died in the Chaz. And somebody pointed out to us that nobody was shot and died in Chaz. They were shot outside of Chaz and then wandered into Chaz. And the denizens of Chaz refused police because that's the point of them. And the guy died inside of Chaz. So we do want to be fair and say that while Chaz might have been culpable for the person's death because the refusal of authorities inside the anti-authority zone, they were not shot and killed in Chaz, as we humorously mentioned last week.
Okay. Thank you for the correction.
Thank you. Yes. What one more spot that I can't go to without fear of recrimination as a journalist. I'll avoid the Chaz area, having made jokes about it previously.
So the other day, just to let people know that Seattle is not a hellscape entirely. I went for a walk here in Seattle and saw a bald eagle catch a fish and then go and eat it up in a tree. And so, of course, I sang America the Beautiful and cried, and mm-hmm. it was just a beautiful, beautiful moment. But Seattle has its perks aside from, you know, dying.
Jen, you have no idea how much it pisses me off that I am in the middle of the Carson National Forest in a giant canyon, and I have not seen a bald eagle. And you, walking to fucking Starbucks in Seattle, get to see a bald eagle catch a fish. That just doesn't seem fair.
I have heard eagles described as vultures with better agents, that they are just carrion birds that in areas, like, they're not particularly rare in the areas that they are in any more than any other bird that normally, like, gathers in certain areas. But they're really unglamorous, kind of dumb, stupid birds, much in the way that we think of vultures as.
I wouldn't say unglamorous, because I was very excited to see the bald eagle. I was standing there filming it like an idiot, and everyone there is from Seattle, and they're just like, okay, weird bird lady, but I didn't leave until the eagle left. The bald ones are cool, but it's not my first one. They really are everywhere around here, which is amazing, and I love it.
Justin, the eagle as vulture motif was a position of Benjamin Franklin, who thought that picking a... basically an aerial thief as the vision of the country was a bad idea. He wanted to go with turkey. He thought that
turkey was
very indigenous to North America. He thought it was a noble bird. I think we should go with a bison, which I believe is the American mammal. But I feel like the bison, it's very specific to the United States. Europeans could make fun of it for being big and dumb, but also you don't want to fuck with one. So I think the bison's pretty good.
Yeah. Of course, Ben Franklin would go with a fat bird, though.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a little projection.
It's probably horny, too. One would assume that turkeys have a lot of sex, one would assume.
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young. From a basement in Seattle, Washington,
I'm Jen Briney.
And from the middle of nowhere...
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We're going to be discussing sports washing from the Saudi Arabian government in the wake of their merger with the PGA Tour and the first religious charter school approved in America. Folks, it's a Catholic school story. And an Oklahoma story. The Heaton briny vibes on this B block are off the charts, as well as your emails. Let's go ahead and get right into this. The PGA Tour has agreed to merge with the Saudi-backed rival LIV Golf, creating a larger golf enterprise and ending ongoing litigation between the two. The Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund, which backs LIV Golf, is set to invest billions in the new entity, and the details of what the new organization are going to be have yet to be disclosed, although I think we know who's going to be driving the car here, or at least the golf cart. The merger has garnered significant controversy, however, due to Saudi Arabia's history of human rights violations, leading to protests from 9/11 Families United and criticism over sports washing. Now, the Saudi Public Investment Fund is estimated at $620 billion and has been much more prominent after a 2014 decision that allowed it to invest in foreign entities. For example, on the business side, the PIF holds minority interests in Boeing, Facebook, Citigroup, Disney, BP, and Uber. but it's the human rights abuses of Saudi Arabia and its alleged sports washing of those crimes, quote unquote, that has garnered the kingdom the most press in the Western world. For example, in 2020, the PIF bought controlling interest in football club Newcastle United for around $300 million. In 2018, American professional wrestling promotion WWE announced a 10-year deal with the Ministry of Sport in Saudi Arabia to stage yearly pay-per-views. And that was doubled to twice yearly soon after. Each event makes the WWE around $55 million. But all of that was small potatoes compared to LIV, their golf league. In October 2021, PIF established LIV Golf and launched a professional tour as a challenge to the PGA Tour, the number one tour throughout Europe and America. They offered big money to big stars to come and play, many of which did. They also offered the richest golf tournaments in history with a total prize money per season of $255 million. Prominent professional golfers like Phil Mickelson, Dustin Johnson, and among others participated in the event, including Brooks Koepka, who won the PGA Championship not but 2 weeks ago. So, in case you're wondering whether or not this is a merger of equals, the head of this new organization is the head of the public investment fund. This golf internationally will now be driven by Saudi Arabia. Heaton, while I know that your golf acumen is off the charts, what I'm going to ask you to start with here is just the idea of sports washing. Do you buy the concept that Saudi Arabia is using big public events that garner a lot of press to distract people from their record on human rights?
I don't think they care that much. I think it's probably that there's several princes within Saudi Arabia that just really enjoy golf. I'm not letting them off the hook morally here. I'm just saying that I think they're probably more concerned with hanging out with golfers. And frankly, I don't even understand how that works in Saudi Arabia. Isn't the whole thing a sand trap? Like, is it one of those kind of UAE billionaire things where they build like giant malls with golf courses in them? I'm not sure how they're doing
yes.
it. So it makes sense then that they'd want to buy up a bunch of other golf things in countries that have grass so they could go play it over there. So that's my suspicion. I think that this is probably billionaire oil princes wanting to get involved in a game in the same way that like Russian oligarchs buy British football teams for fun. I doubt it's as much of a PR thing because I don't know. I suspect it's more toys than PR.
Jen, you're a lot more plugged in to the sports side of this, and the sports washing narrative is pretty omnipresent whenever anything related to Saudi Arabian money is discussed. Do you buy the concept of sports washing?
No, and especially not in this case, because before LIV was created, no one was talking about Saudi Arabia at all. No one was discussing their ties to 9/11. We were just continuing to sell them weapons and no one cared. And so this has actually brought more attention on Saudi Arabia in a negative way. I mean, they offered Tiger Woods over $750 million to go over to that tour and he said no. So that was nothing but bad press for them when that happened. And in fact, I saw a great tweet this morning after the merger was announced that said that the PGA is going to control holes 1 through 8 and 12 through 18, and Saudi Arabia is going to control holes 9 through 11.
All right. All right.
So that's not a good look, you know? Like
Tiger Woods turned down $750 million?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, essentially, so the PGA, obviously, the final word in golf up till this point, they were desperately trying to hold on to the names that were being offered ungodly sums of money. No one bigger than Tiger Woods. And it would have been an extraordinarily lucrative deal because Tiger does not have many tournaments left. He's got a lot more behind him than he does in front of him. He is obviously not in peak health, but for Tiger, and this is what, you know, this is delving more into the golf side of this. There was a lot of litigation on whether or not LIV golfers were allowed to compete in what are called the majors, the four big tournaments that tend to define whether or not you are a great golfer or just somebody who plays it professionally.
Okay.
And Tiger desperately wants to win majors. There was a question on whether or not LIV golfers would be able to play in majors. And so he turned down $750 million. And now a lot of the people who turned down that money for the love of the PGA, who they believed were going to fight the good fight, are kind of screwed because they could have got that money and then kept playing in all the majors. Cause guess what? All the LIV players that left wound up playing in the majors anyway. Everything was tied up in litigation throughout all this process. And then the PGA said, wait a minute, if you're going to pay Tiger $750 million, how much will you pay us, the people who owed the PGA?
He made a very big mistake there. What he should have done is taken the money and then immediately given it to like a Saudi Arabian human rights group or Saudi Arabian democratic dissidents or something that would piss off the regime. Like, take all that money and then immediately do a really big check on TV, giving it over to a group against the authoritarian regime that paid him. That would have been a cool
okay
move. And then if the Masters had said, you can't promote the Masters anymore, go on a big propaganda tour of, I guess the PGA is against me helping anti-authoritarians.
But that's not why he turned down the money. He turned down the money because he wanted to continue to play on the PGA tour. So it wasn't like he was standing with 9/11 victims. I mean, some of them said that they were when they turned down the money, but it was more the PGA. And this is why there were lawsuits. So this whole merger kills these lawsuits because it was like an anti-monopoly situation, because the PGA Tour was saying, if you play with this new LIV Tour, you can't play on the PGA Tour. They made them choose. And so that's why he did it. It wasn't. And that's kind of like the crazy thing for me is like, if there was ever a chance of these two tours merging, it was the PGA that ran with the whole, you know, if you side with LIV, you're siding with the terrorists of 9/11. They didn't have to do that. And so the hypocrisy of them then merging the tours, it looks terrible for the PGA. And it's really a self-own here. They didn't have to do it. They were just trying to win these lawsuits until they decided to settle and merge the tours. It's all stupid.
And they will build a mask of humiliation with the millions and billions of dollars that they will split amongst them. But Heaton, to go back to your point, this is part of the reason why the Saudi Arabian thing will always be a little bit ugly. Because for your example, let's say Tiger Woods did donate a bunch of money to a Saudi Arabian human rights group. That is a group of people for whom does not like being humiliated. They don't like being humiliated in gossiping circles. They don't like being humiliated in the pages of the Washington Post, which is why, on the direction of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, one of their dissidents was lured into a honey trap and bone sawed. He was murdered, tortured, and bone sawed. This is not with Saudi Arabia. This isn't like calling Trump Orange Cheeto and laughing all the way to the Twitter bank. These guys play for keeps there in the kingdom.
Justin, I am totally willing to gamble with Tiger Woods' life in order to get $750 million for a trolling operation. That is, I think I'm willing to take the risk.
But I mean, there is a serious question here, because it's not only the fact that there were ties to members of the Saudi royal family with 9/11, and obviously the hijackers came from there. And I'm sure we are going to get emails from people that either are adjacent to or live in Saudi Arabia that can explain a little bit more of the insane Game of Thrones palace intrigue that goes into the House of Saud and all of that, and who was for and who was against X, Y, or Z.
Didn't they, a couple of years ago, just take all of the members of the royal family and lock them at a hotel? And they're like, you could just stay here till you pay us more money. Like, it was like, no, I don't think anybody got hurt, but there was an imminent threat that was sort of dancing in the background.
So essentially that was the moment of announcement of the new person for whom runs Saudi Arabia, which is Mohammed bin Salman. He is the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. And he, you know, and again, somebody who knows this more than I do will be able to explain how much of it was extortion, how much of it was anti-corruption, where he was showing that he was the new boss in charge and that people had to give back money that they had stolen from X, Y, or Z. But the thing we do know is that They do not take their enemies lightly. They are brutal in how they enforce their rules. According to the PR elements of Saudi Arabia, they are a modernizing country. Women can drive now. So, Jen, if you ever wanted to stop at the Hertz rental car in Riyadh, you could now pick up a sporty little coupe and drive around.
Lucky me.
Yeah.
Well, I got to say there is a point there. Mohammed bin Salman, who is an authoritarian, is also the most modern and liberal authoritarian that Saudi Arabia has ever had. Like, he is somebody that is pushing Saudi Arabia in a better direction than it was. I'm not saying I'd take him over a liberal democratic regime, but like, they have been making some inroads positively the last few years, and I hope they keep going that direction.
But I guess here's my larger question, and especially with a country like Saudi Arabia that has direct ties to America and the Western world, that we would understand, for the sake of this argument, is among the more liberal and progressive in the world, if we are going to look at the Western world as an example of pushing these kinds of things forward. Is there a line that we should have culturally in connecting to areas that do not share, at least on some levels, the values of Western democracy and culture? Because that, I think, is the issue here.
We sell them weapons. If we give a single fuck about human rights, we wouldn't sell them things that kill people. So when it comes to golf, who gives a shit? Like, if we actually cared about human rights in Saudi Arabia, we would stop selling them weapons. So until we stop doing that, all of this is just hypocrisy and ridiculous.
Well, but who's we here? Let's define we, because the government sells them weapons. I don't, like, it's not a national plebiscite where we all check yes or no, should we sell weapons to Saudi Arabia?
The thing is, though, we've been doing it for decades. We've been doing it since 9/11. We know we're selling them weapons, and we continue to vote for people who sell them weapons. So we don't make it an issue in our elections. And so I do think there is a point where we have to say we sell them weapons, because we have, by not giving a shit and never bringing it up in elections, we have kind of put our rubber stamp on it, be like, yeah, we're okay with this.
I mean, Joe Biden ran on the idea that Saudi Arabia and Mohammed bin Salman would be shamed into the position that they should be. Let me look up the exact quote on that. But Biden did do some tough talk about Saudi Arabia.
And then what did he do as president?
Well, you can fill in the rest there.
He was also vice president for 8 years during the Obama administration when we sold Saudi Arabia weapons. So I think the whole idea that we're going to get all angry about them being involved in golf and allow this in our government where we do have a say. I mean, all of these golfing organizations are private organizations. Our government is not. It is something we actually have a say in. So if that is something we're going to allow to then draw the line at golf, it's silly.
Let me quote Joe Biden from the debates in the run-up to the 2020 election. Quote, I would make it very clear that we are not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them. We are going to, in fact, make them pay the price, make them, in fact, the pariah that they are. There is very little social redeeming value in the present government in Saudi Arabia.
Didn't he run down to Saudi Arabia to remind them what great allies we are? Like shortly before,
yeah, but that
shortly
was,
after
but that was after that was after gas prices went up. So
yeah, Saudi Arabia is a very good piece of evidence for the realist camp in foreign policy relations. This comes up a lot when we're talking about Ukraine. It comes up a lot when we're talking about international conflict. Is the thing that's motivating a country its values? Is it just raw power? People that are in the muscular liberalism camp, the neoliberals, and pretty much everybody currently in the State Department and the last three American administrations. I'll give a little bit of a pass to Trump because he was less of this, but they tend to take the position that, you know, what we're animated by is promoting liberal democracy abroad, and we stand with countries that share our values and so on and so forth. And the big flaring flag that draws attention to that is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia sure looks to me like what we're ultimately concerned with is power, and that the realists are probably right.
Power and money, because like Justin just said, it's an oil deal too. But yeah, if you're saying that we stand for democracy around the world and then we're allied with the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, it just kind of points out how hollow all of that is.
But Jen, not just a kingdom, a theocratic kingdom.
I do think that it's kind of bullshit to say that because we vote for presidents that do not differentiate or make a moral stand on Saudi Arabia, that that means that people can't be disgusted or have an opinion on Saudi Arabia and their involvement in our leisure activities.
Like, I didn't say that they can't have an opinion, but it's just if
you just
not,
think it's bullshit.
I just think that if you're not equally as angry, if not more angry, about us selling them weapons, like you're worried about human rights, they kill people with weapons and we give them the weapons. Like that is a bigger deal than them making money off of golf. It just is.
Hey, Justin.
Yeah.
I will meet you on this. Jen, to your point, I think you make a very, very good distinction that is very relevant to our conversation here between the public and private sphere. I get far more animated about the misappropriation of public resources than I do about private stuff because I don't have to participate in the private stuff. So thank you for making that distinction. I agree with you on that. Now that we're in the private sphere, we're talking about are there moral norms which should govern private organizations in dealing with bad regimes, I think that that's an interesting topic that we can explore. I find it immediately murky, though, because so many of the countries that we do business with, and I say we as in private individuals and companies, also have all sorts of problematic things going on. We do a ton of business with China. It's been to the benefit of the United States and the Chinese people. The Chinese people, due to our trade with them, have risen out of poverty over the last 50 years. It's been a good thing for them and a humanitarian blessing. But at the same time, they're involved in all sorts of horrible things with the Uyghurs. The regime itself is totalitarian and censorious and you know does not tolerate dissent and lots of things like that. So I'm not sure how – I don't know how you would draw the bright line or what the bright line would look like. Do you have an idea for that, Justin?
Well, part of me is playing a little bit of devil's advocate because I do think at the end of the day, we have to understand that the world is a very complicated, ugly, and murky place. And even decisions like selling Saudi Arabia weapons, the realist camp foreign policy wise on that is that, hey, look, they're going to buy weapons somewhere. And so either it is us or China or Russia that will sell it to them because there's only X amount of militaries that have the kind of production that they need so they can buy the weapons that they want. And so while that might be an excuse that you can tell yourself before you go to sleep or a realistic foreign policy decision where yes, it makes sense to sell to the Saudis so somebody else does not continue to build a closer relationship with them, I will leave that up to foreign policy minds. While we are in the funhouse mirror world of entertainment, of professional wrestling, of Premier League soccer, of golf, I do think that sometimes real world stuff like the Saudi Arabian government's involvement in it, much in the same way that they are funding Boeing, Facebook, Citigroup, Disney, BP, and Uber, is something that people can have an opinion about. Now, whether or not that drives them to not watch golf, not watch professional wrestling, not patronize Facebook, Citigroup, Disney, BP, or Uber, that is up to them as consumers. But I do think that it's an interesting conversation and people are valid to have their opinion.
Which is fine. Go ahead and have your opinion, but where's the line, right? Because like we have this whole PGA thing and like, yes, Saudi Arabia seems to have taken over the entire PGA, but you just listed a bunch of companies. I also would like to add Live Nation to that. So if you buy a concert ticket in the United States, you're giving some money to Saudi Arabia because the funds invested in that. And then
if you saw Taylor Swift this summer, Jamal Khashoggi's blood is on your hands.
Exactly. Where's the line?
So, yeah, Justin, thank you for bringing this up. I'd like to point out now that the reason that I don't go to Live Nation events or golf tournaments is because of my upstanding moral credentials. And I am better than you and most of the people listening. It is entirely for moral reasons that I am boycotting these services. And I accept everyone's moral applause.
Okay.
So where is your line personally, Jen?
I guess I land on I can't care. Like all these companies and just the way the stock market works and how anyone can invest in anything. If I were to boycott all of the companies that did stuff that I was against or every country that did something bad, like I would have to go and join Andrew in New Mexico and live out in a field and eat bugs, because it's just they're all, it seems like they're all tainted. So I don't like golf to begin with, but my husband's going to keep watching. His dad's going to keep watching. It just like is what it is. I tend to get more upset about things that can corrupt my government. So it's like when it comes to Saudi Arabia's influence, I don't love that the minute that the Kushners got out of the White House, they got a $2 billion deal with the Saudis. That annoys me far more than something like this.
Wait, so, do the Saudis pay them to go golfing, Jen? Is Jared Kushner go to that tournament?
Although I should mention that the LIV tournaments were doing a lot of their events at Trump properties.
Yes. That is the political angle on this. Donald Trump was a big backer of LIV Golf. Donald Trump was a host at his golf tournaments for LIV Golf. He will now almost assuredly be doing PGA events, which he has done in the past, but they were a little upset with him as he moved into politics. But even said, 1 year ago, there's a Truth Social post that is going around saying all of the players who are not taking the Saudi money are going to really feel like assholes when the inevitable merger between LIV and the PGA happens, and they're going to be have made this moral decision for literally nothing. And guess what? You got to give the Chungus his due. He called that one from a mile away.
He sure did. So that's the type of corruption when it comes to governments involved in things that upsets me a lot more, because that can affect our policy and what is done in our names. But when it comes to this golf stuff, like, I don't really care.
Is there a sports line for which you would have to make a more personal decision? Because as you are not a professional wrestling fan, you are not a fan of Premier League soccer, you are not a fan of sports. Is there, let's say, you know, a sports team for which that would be purchased by the Saudi public investment fund that would at least make you have to have an emotional decision about this kind of stuff?
I don't know. Because, I mean, you know that I'm an NFL fan.
Yeah.
And Dan Snyder still owns his team. And that, you know, he
for
was,
now.
For now.
Now,
well, I mean, they keep saying like they're forcing him to sell the team. Like when?
No. There's an agreement in principle that's being ratified by the NFL, but the Philadelphia 76ers owner.
But this went on for years, and he's allowed to keep the team, and I'm still watching the NFL. Like I said, it probably doesn't reflect well upon me that I'm not willing to pretend to care about these things, but I don't know. Right now, I can't think of a scenario. No.
So, all right. Robert Kraft shaking hands with Mohammed bin Salman at Foxborough. Tom Brady's there smiling and clapping. Bill Belichick is, you know, he reads something that was, you know, designed for the Saudi Arabian market. Does that make you blanch any? Because I know you are a Patriots fan.
I am a Patriots fan, but I also, like, I don't get all that crazy about the decisions made by other countries. Like, if the Saudi Arabians want to live under a kingdom and they don't want to do anything about it, that's not really my business. I don't live there. So I'm not about to protest the Saudis. I mean, 9/11 happened 25 years ago. We've done nothing about it. I'm not going to control that by turning against the Patriots. Like, it's, I don't know.
Justin, I, for one, am boycotting the NFL. Until they make better decisions with their funds and they quit taking stadium subsidies. And then the other thing I'll bring up is volleyballs are all made with slave labor. So for that reason, I never play volleyball.
Oh, my God.
All right. What would the Saudis have to buy to make this personal for you? Like would they have to buy Marie's Crisis? Like, would they have to buy?
I think Star Trek.
All right, so Star Trek. So, okay. They buy, which, look. It only takes one nerdy chic son to have that happen. that can happen tomorrow. You have no idea how fast.
So, okay, let's say that both of these would be positive. I got to say, both of these would be positive developments. If they bought Marie's Crisis a gay bar, there would have to be some level of increasing sympathy for gays. It would be a positive thing, I think, if they were that, if they really, really enjoyed musical theater that much. It was Star Trek. Like Star Trek is deeply, deeply pluralistic and tolerant. It's about people having differences and being able to work past them towards a good common goal. I don't know. I would encourage all of the sheiks listening to our program to hang out with me at Marie's Crisis, sing some songs, including 9,525 minutes. I'm butchering that from Rent. It's kind of like the gay anthem. It's a terrific song. Sing it with me. And then we'll watch Star Trek together.
Justin, I want to turn this one on you since you're so woke. What would it take for you to turn against your sports?
Oh, no.
Because Ben Roethlisberger being all rapey didn't seem to bother you.
No. I've long made my peace with the idea that sports is a business of distraction and entertainment. And, the complicated world that surrounds it infects it. And it is not a pure place for which we can have a rest from stuff. It is just a funhouse mirror of the world around us. So if the Rooney family, flew to Riyadh and sold the Pittsburgh Steelers to the Saudi Public Investment Fund, it would be a bit of a transition, I gotta say. It would be, because it would lose an element of that family-owned ethos of the Pittsburgh Steelers becoming Rooney owned out of a poker game. It's a very plucky American immigrant kind of story for that team, regardless of the players that are on it. It would give me pause, but I don't think it would make me stop watching. The one thing that I'm very much annoyed by is that you guys both came in on sports washing is bullshit, which I was really banking on being my counterintuitive take, because I fucking hate the idea. And Heaton, you, the person who knows the least about all this, had my exact take immediately in the first five words, because it's like, no, they bone sawed a Washington Post journalist. Like, they bone sawed this dude. And then we're like, yep, we did it. Like, do you think that they give a rat's ass if a bunch of sports bloggers and John Oliver does a 10-minute monologue? Hell no. The only time that they would care about John Oliver's monologue is if one of the sheik's son really got into John Oliver and they'd buy him. Like, that's the only time that they would ever care about any kind of American or Western media take. Otherwise, they're royalty. And they do royalty things, that's just them. That's what they do. They have more money than God, and they act like it.
And as a fan of sports, like, I'm trying to think, like, what would make me turn against the Patriots? And the only thing really is if they leave New England. It's when, like, I'm rooting for the city.
Like, what if one of your best players was a murderer or something? Like a serial murderer.
And like spits out his gum next to the body, and therefore we find out.
Like a really dumb serial murderer.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I'm still a Patriots fan, but like, I'm rooting for the city. Like, I'm not rooting for the Kraft family, you know? Yeah. It's so I think the ownership, like, if people are still going to watch the PGA, I'm not going to hold that against them, because they're fans of the sport of golf. They're fans of Mickelson and Tiger Woods and whoever else plays golf. I don't know or care. It's not about the ownership for the people that are watching these sports.
Hey, Justin, to go back to your prior point about what the bright line is, I think one of the things that makes it so murky is it's much easier to not do business with an individual than it is to do business with a group, because the group just becomes soupy. And the larger the group, the more soupy it is, the more murky it is. Like, if in Austin, we go to a restaurant and we watch the owner of the restaurant shout at his staff and say a racial epithet and then spit in the food or something, we can go, that guy's a dick. I don't want to do business with that guy. I'm not going to patron here anymore. But
you mean that girl? You're talking about Paula Deen, right?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, Jesus.
Who is a Saudi prince? But if we're talking about, like, you know, the Disney Corporation did something, it's so immense that to think of it in terms of singular motivation becomes very difficult. There might be philosophical constructs that smarter people than I have come up with that will allow them to navigate these waters. But on my end, it's much easier to go, this one thing where I can see the people and I can tell who's responsible for what. I'm much more capable of making an ethical bright line for that than I am for larger groups.
Yeah. I think that part of the narrative around this is also the Western world's, and let's just say America's, main character syndrome, And I think that part of it is understandable. We all are the heroes of our own story, and collectively America, part of the American identity is our pride and self-loathing complex. And we do believe that everything kind of wraps around us and everything is about us. And it's sometimes it's justified because America, look, in America, I barely hear anything about England. I barely hear anything about Italy. I barely hear anything about any of the other countries that I have been to. But every other time that I've gone to those countries, I know what happens in America because it is on their newspapers and it is in their television. So there is an element of justifiable main character syndrome that America has, but sometimes it warps into this very weird place like this conversation where it's like, oh, the Saudis are buying our sports teams because they want us to like them. How gross, how weird. Let's talk about how awful they are. And that's not to say that they're not awful. I think we've done, you know, service to explain the criticisms of the Saudi Arabian government. Let's also say that homosexuality is criminalized and brutally enforced in that country. If we forgot any crime of the Saudi Arabian regime, please go ahead and email us. But it's not about us. It's about them. They want to buy golf because they want, because they like golf, and they bought F1 teams because they like F1.
And because there's a lot of money in it. They're doing it to make money.
I mean, yes, and they bought a lot of things that don't make money because they, you know, like I think that this WWE deal is there. It's essentially, you know, whatever the Islamic version of a gigantic bar mitzvah for like all their kids. When you watch those pay-per-views, it's just all of the sheik's kids that just run around like it's a Chuck E. Cheese in the first 10 rows. And then everybody else, they go and they sell tickets because otherwise the stadium would look empty and that's weird. But like everything, it doesn't have to make money.
Yeah, it's about status and showing off. It's not about acquiring more resources.
When it comes to owning the PGA Tour, I think there's a lot to do with money. There's an absurd amount of money in golf. And I think now that they've taken over the tour, which by creating a competitor, showering it with money, and then finding a way to take over the PGA Tour, they're going to make shitloads of money off of this. There's no way around it. They just are.
But even then, all right, let's say that the annual profit from this new organization, which the
which
is Saudi
gonna be
investment
for-profit, it's not going to be a not-for-profit like the PGA was. I saw it. It's going to be a for-profit organization now.
Yeah.
So they've even changed the structure.
And it's gonna get billions of dollars in investment mm-hmm. from the Saudis. Do we believe that it will make billions of dollars in profit over the next 10 years? I don't know. Maybe it will.
I mean, if they can I think about how much money just the players get. Like, there's absurd amounts of money in golf. Maybe that investment will, maybe.
But I don't know. I think that they looked at LIV as a loss leader, and I think they're going to look at this new organization as a loss leader.
But looking at this on, like, a bigger picture, like, what if they were creating LIV so that this exact situation would happen? What if that was a play to take over the entire world tour? Because they also got, we haven't talked about the European tour. They took that one too. So they now control all of golf. Like, that's an enormous amount of money if you now control all of the tours and get a cut of all the proceeds.
I don't disagree that there's a lot of money there. I think the only thing that we might disagree on is if we were in a room with the Saudi Public Investment Fund, is what we describe as a lot of money and what they describe as a lot of money. Because I don't think that our scale is even close. Like, what we think is a lot of money are millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions. What their $620 billion public investment fund thinks is a lot of money, I think is on a scale totally different to how we are looking at it.
Yeah, we're talking about a group of people that builds islands shaped like countries for fun. Like, if you want to live in an island that looks like France, they'll just build you one. You got to pay like, you know, $40 million for it. Or I might be confusing some of this with the UAE, but the concept is the same, which is petrodollars. Like one of the countries, it's either UAE or Saudi Arabia. The license plates are like it goes from like 001 up. and you pay like $40 million to have 001. It has literally no benefit other than being a license plate. That's it. It's just a license plate. All it is, it's a license plate that says, I paid $40 million for this license plate. To have that kind of money, crazy money.
I still think they're going to make money on the tour. That's all. I don't think this is a controversial statement.
Could be.
I actually don't know. I would and we can do our sports take spinoff of this show. Me and you, Jen, we can be our Stephen A. Smith impressions. But like, I don't know for sure if the reporting is correct. And let's say they're putting $4 billion into this, and they want to make it the biggest spectacle possible. I do not know, and this is purely my ignorance about golf economics. I do not know if the PGA currently pulls in revenue, or the combined entities pull in revenue in the billions every year, or if this is a 10-year and annualized thing. Somebody, I'm sure, with a sense of golf and economics will email us on the show next week, and we will discuss it. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Hey, Heaton.
Yes.
Let me tell you this. I got pulled into your Discord the other day. Yeah.
How
because
was it?
Your Discord was alleging that I don't say on the show that we're not wrong pod at gmail.com does not have an apostrophe. So allow me to clear up one more time that we're not wrong pod at gmail.com has no apostrophe in it. That's what you are writing to. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com.
Are you even allowed to have an apostrophe in an email address?
Leave it to Heaton's Discord to figure out. Yes. Apparently
really?
You are. Apparently you are.
Well, why don't we have no both? Idea. Can we set up both so that these morons can figure it out?
Oh, Jesus.
This isn't that hard.
Heaton's Heathens, my Discord group, Heaton's Heathens, which I invite everybody to visit. I didn't pick the name, by the way. If you want to hang out with people that like talking politics without being a dick, that seems to be the main drive. Once again, you all have held Justin to truth. You forced him to you know, keep his head on a swivel, and you've done some research for us. I thank you.
Yeah, well, yeah. Go, good on you. Patreon.com/we're not wrong is where you need to go if you want to get a bonus version of the show and you want to support us, because we are marching. We are marching toward 900, seeing if we can summit Mount 1000. Patreon.com/we're not wrong. And you want to know what? As the summer comes along, a lot of people on trips, a lot of people in cars, a lot of people going from one place to another. This is a show that has a very high percentage of converts. If you know somebody that likes these kinds of shows, likes Blacked and Reported or Fifth Column or anything like that, if you have not recommended this show, I would encourage you to do so right now. And then we can convert them to Patreon. This is the way that we go onward and upward. But also, they will know that you get a bonus episode when you are a patron. So it's not only just these two topics. We get a bonus extra topic. And this week, it is about the $3,500 new Apple product, the Apple Vision Pro. Economics, technology, whether or not it's just a stroke machine. We're going to talk all about it on the Patreon. Patreon.com/we're not wrong. And guess what? There's not an apostrophe in that either.
$3,500 stroke machine is something I'd be interested in looking at.
$3,500 stroke machine is my Jimmy Buffett cover album. Oklahoma has approved the opening of the nation's first publicly funded religious charter school following a split vote by the Oklahoma Statewide Virtual Charter School Board. This landmark decision, led by a Catholic initiative to open the St. Isidore of Seville Catholic Virtual School, has stirred controversy, particularly among state officials. Governor Kevin Stitt supports this decision, viewing it as an expression of religious liberty and educational innovation, while Attorney General Gettner Drummond has criticized it as contradicting state law and misusing taxpayer money. The approval has also sparked legal concerns, with critics suggesting that the decision breaches the separation of church and state. Rachel Laser, head of the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, has suggested a lawsuit challenging this decision is likely. Furthermore, the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools has voiced its opposition, emphasizing that charter schools as public schools should be non-sectarian according to both state law and U.S. Constitution. The decision has opened up a broader debate about the use of public funds for religious or sectarian purposes, which could potentially escalate all the way up to that U.S. Supreme Court. So, should taxpayer money go to a religious school, Jen Briney?
Absolutely not. And I don't think it's going to have to go all the way to the Supreme Court. I feel like this one is quite open and shut. But one of the things that made me stop and look at this article and just be interested in this story is this was one of the things that people were nervous about when charter schools started to become a thing. Because charter schools are public schools. They are funded with public money, but they are somehow exempt from a bunch of education laws. Like there's all these, you know, hippie schools where kids go and play in the dirt and they call it school. And some parents love their charter schools. We're going to get so many emails about how they love their charter. I get it. You love your different school, but there was a concern that this was going to go so far as to open the door for religious schools to get public funding. And oh, look at this. That's exactly what's happening. They're trying to get around these prohibitions that were in state laws and in our Constitution. And I think it's a problem for the charter schools. For the people that like their charter schools, the fact that the Public Alliance for Charter Schools, something like their lobbying organization being against this is a good thing because it does make charter schools look like a runaround of the law. And this is the most extreme example yet of that being the case. So I'm pleasantly surprised to see that the Alliance is against this, but we have a separation of church and state in this country that seems to be dissolving all the time with, the Christian perspective becoming more and more a part of our government. And this is just the next step in that. Like I've seen COVID money went to private religious schools, which you can understand because it was an emergency, but it's like, we've seen this creep of public money into religious schools and this is like the next step in that. And so I welcome the lawsuits and I really hope this gets shut down.
Heaton, after 30 years of the charter school conversation and implementation, we have one religious school. Will anybody stop this streak?
I sure hope the Oklahoma Supreme Court steps in and stops it, which I think is a pretty good track record on this kind of malarkey. Let me split this into two different categories. The first one is I don't think that at all public funding should be going to religious schools. I'm 100% with Jen on that one, and I want to elaborate on that in a moment. I do want to preface that with, I like charter schools. I don't have any kids, but I'm one of the people that will email into the show and say charter schools are good. And I think that this is a huge misstep for charter schools as somebody that is very much in favor of them. The reason that I like charter schools is I want there to be more innovation in education, and I want there to be more competition of models. That way, parents and students have different options available to them. I think competition tends to benefit systems, and it's a good thing. And having bottom-up experimentation occurring where if it works well, it can be replicated, and in doing it kind of on a case-by-case basis as opposed to having a big, massive federal apparatus or state apparatus is a very, very positive thing for education. So I'm very much in favor of this. If you go back like 20, 30 years, Justin, as you bring up, my read is not that charter schools were the yay red team, boo blue team position that they were. When I started looking into charter schools, the big experimenter with charter schools was Washington, D.C., which no one accuses of being conservative or Republican or anything like that. And at the time, charter schools as a movement had not really catalyzed as being a Democratic or Republican issue. At the time, they were just an educational experiment, and it was very popular within Washington, D.C., within Democratic circles, because it did a lot to really bolster their education output and get test scores better. And it was just a very positive thing. At some point, it became the enemy of teachers' unions, and then that being a very large group within the Democratic coalition, it's kind of become a libertarian, conservative thing and opposed by Democrats. And I think that the current thing that they're doing in Oklahoma of making a charter school that is Catholic is only further entrenching it in blue team versus red team stuff. It's now, okay, not only is it going to be reviled by teachers' unions and therefore something that Democrats don't like, now we're going to affiliate it with religious institutions and make it something that conservatives like. I think that's a huge misstep for charter schools going forward. The Alliance is absolutely correct in trying to stop this from occurring. Now, to the broader issue of the money going from public coffers to a private school. Jen is 100% right. This is an absolute violation of church and state. And I don't think that this is coming about because of charter schools. I think this is coming about because of the increasingly accommodationist stance of the court system in the United States. We saw last year Kennedy v. Bremerton, the Supreme Court re-legalized prayer in public schools. And the issue that I had at the time was, what other things is this going to open the door for? Because the Supreme Court had thrown out a lot of case law going back to the 1970s upholding separation of church and state and schools. And if I might briefly give a synopsis of the competing schools here, which I should also state are completely unaffiliated with the political party. We're just talking about jurisprudence at the moment. There's a group of people that think that there should be a very, very hard line between church and state that are called separatists, that sort of view combining the two as an almost chemical reaction. So they just don't want, you can absolutely be religious in the 99% of the rest of the country, but when it comes to things that are public institutions, they need to keep religion out of it. There's a group of people called accommodationalists, which is where the Supreme Court currently is leaning towards. And they take the position that the free exercise of religion is more important than the separation of church and state. They're both provisions of the First Amendment, but they would rather have the individual's free exercise of religion than worry about the government affiliating with religion. And so they tend to want to have a very neutral, kind of a public park mentality, where there's a big park, and if you want to go do Christmas carols in it, that's fine. Where the issue comes in terms of church and state is the park administrator playing favorites with religions. That's where the church and state comes in. I think that that's a legitimate position. I'm more in the separatist camp. But there is this kind of third shadow camp that doesn't have any official bearing in jurisprudence in the United States. There's nobody on the Supreme Court that takes the model that I'm about to describe. But it nonetheless is kind of throughout the country in clumps, and that is sort of soft theocrats. And these are people that want America to look a bit more like Britain or Canada, where there is an official Christian religion that is in the government. And we're tolerant of Hindus and we're tolerant of Muslims and things, but they need to understand that they're in a Christian country. They are around, and they usually camouflage themselves as accommodationalists. And I think that the current situation in Oklahoma is a good test for this. I'm very much against this. I think this is a horrible idea. I think it's going to get struck down by the Oklahoma Supreme Court. I actually don't know that the United States Supreme Court would do it, given what they did with Kennedy v. Bremerton. But the Oklahoma Supreme Court has its head screwed on right when it comes to these matters. A few years ago, somebody tried to put up a Ten Commandments monument on the lawn of the state capitol on accommodationalist grounds, saying, look, we're not saying you have to be Christian. We're just saying that blah, blah, blah law. And the Supreme Court, I think unanimously or with a very, very high majority, went, no, this violates state law. You can't put it in there. Oklahoma state law is actually much more intense about separation of church and state than the U.S. Constitution is. It was founded by populists that were worried about it. So I think this is a very, very bad idea, and I think it's going to get thrown out at the state level. If it doesn't, I worry about whether or not it will happen at the federal level, because the last thing I want is for there to be more erosion of church and state.
I want you all to pay attention to those two takes, because you have seen something truly pure on this edition of the show. Jen Briney's suspicion of a Catholic institution and Andrew Heaton's faith everlasting in Oklahoma judges. I am more on the side that this is, if in the close to 30 years that charter schools have been a conversation, if not a reality in America, if at the 30-year mark we get our first shot at a religious school that gets approved by a state board, I think that's, now we'll see where it goes from here, right? Maybe this opens the floodgates. Maybe this is a much larger problem in 5 years than it is right now. But as it stands now, look, nothing's perfect. I agree that this should not stand, but I don't believe this is an indictment of charter schools in general. And this was a very prescient issue for me growing up, because in Florida, where a lot of the No Child Left Behind policies were being tried out on a state level before they went national with George W. Bush, Jeb Bush, his brother, put in school vouchers and a lot of programs for which teachers' unions were very up in arms. And myself, being a product of a Florida public school, snicker away, was very upset. All of my teachers were extraordinarily upset. They viewed this as the absolute destruction of the public school system. Now, I felt like I got a good education. I do not know what it is now. I do suspect, in what I have modeled from parents that I've talked to about this issue, their opinions on this are not political. In fact, it is an opinion based on options. Do I like the school that I'm zoned for? Do I believe that my kid would do well in the school that I'm zoned for? If so, public schools are great. I love public schools. Public schools are amazing. If not, then they want options, and they want options now, and they feel resentful if they do not get the options that they believe that they can have or that exist in other places, up to the point of moving. There's a reason why home sales are almost entirely dependent cyclically on the school year, because that's when people make decisions on selling their house and moving to another house, and in a lot of cases, in an overrepresented sample. So this, I believe, will not stand. I will through transubstantiation, to use a Catholic metaphor, adopt Heaton's.
Which you can now learn in Oklahoma public schools.
Which you can now do in Oklahoma public schools. I will now take Heaton's faith in Oklahoma judges, because you know a lot more about it than I do. But I don't believe that this is necessarily inherent to the charter school revolution.
But here's the thing about that. If it doesn't stand, then I think you're right that it wasn't an indictment of charter schools. It was someone trying to get away with something. But you've noticed that in actual public schools that are no bullshit public schools, no one's even trying to make them religious schools, because it's so clear that that is a red line that can't be crossed. But because charter schools do so much blurring of the lines, this was the avenue they chose for a reason, to make it a charter school that is religious, that gets public funding. They're not trying this with regular public schools. So that's where I think that charter school aspect really matters, is because they've changed, like, you know, on a national level, we require schools to cater to kids with special needs. Charter schools don't have to. There's a graying of the lines. So this was a graying of the lines that this particular group of people decided to take advantage of to try to get public money into a religious school. If it doesn't work, that actually speaks highly of the charter system. But I think it does speak to something, that this was the avenue they chose.
Jen, I think your causality is off, in that this is a manifestation of what's going on with the courts and not what's going on with public schools. And the reason I say that is that the bright line you're describing is not something that's always been there. It's something that was enforced by the courts. If we go back to 1970, 1972, I'm somewhere around that time, we have a court case called Lemon v. Kurtzman. In Lemon v. Kurtzman, in the state of Pennsylvania, a government program was brought to the Supreme Court and ultimately struck down. At that time, under Pennsylvania law, public schools in Pennsylvania, or I should say the Department of Education in Pennsylvania, public spending on education, could go to private teachers at Catholic schools and other religious institutions. The way that Pennsylvania had it set up at the time was that they would allocate funding and hire employees as supplementary teachers for the Department of Education at Catholic schools, parochial schools, religious things, and so on and so forth, so long as they were teaching a secular subject. So you could get a teacher that teaches history at a Catholic school, and that teacher's salary would be paid for by the Department of Education in Pennsylvania. And basically, they just had to promise that they weren't going to be teaching a sectarian subject. They were only going to be teaching math or history or so on and so forth. Lemon v. Kurtzman calls that into question, and was ultimately that policy was struck down by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's logic, which I believe was correct, was, look, this is soupy. This is messy. There's no way that you're going to be able to take somebody that is hired at a Catholic institution which cares about the moral character and the theological bearings of its staff, rightly so, it's a Catholic institution, and then be able to make a mental barrier that completely excises any threat of religious indoctrination going in. At the same time, if you have public employees operating at a private school, the state now has a vested interest in going to the private school and seeing how they're educating things. And you may not want that. You might want to have a separation from the state not interfering with your parochial school. So the Supreme Court struck it down. And that became the law of the land in the United States for the last 30 years. And it's a significant reason why you haven't seen experimentation with public schools in places like Oklahoma teaching religious doctrination, which I can tell you they would absolutely do regardless of whether or not they're charter schools. There's a strong theocratic impulse in my part of the country that would love for that to be there. Just like in Texas right now, there's a bill in the Senate trying to get the Ten Commandments into every single classroom in the United or in Texas. What changes, and the reason that this is now happening, is not because charter schools have done anything different in the last 30 years. It's because Lemon v. Kurtzman was overturned last year in Kennedy v. Bremerton. In Kennedy v. Bremerton, a football coach would pray after games and invite students to do it. And that was previously against federal law because of Kennedy v. Kurtzman. That got up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, because the coach is not compelling kids to pray with him, it is an invitation and optional thing that he is doing. The fact that a public administrator on public land at a public event is engaging in prayer doesn't really matter because it's neutral and it's not coercive. They overturned Lemon v. Kurtzman. And then what happened? All of a sudden, all of the groups that wanted to breach that church and state realized that there's holes in the armor, that the Supreme Court is much more accommodationalist than it is separatist, and they're moving in that direction. So I think that this is all downriver of jurisprudence, and I don't think that it's anything unique to charter schools.
So I don't disagree with that at all. I think if we're actually looking at causation, like, you're probably right, but I do think that there is something to the fact that this group of people that wanted a religious school saw a door open in the charter school structure.
I mean, again, in Texas, the state that I live in, the public schools are right now looking at the possibility of having religious iconography inside of them in the form of the Ten Commandments. The type of religious institution the type of educational institution I think is very secondary to the goals of the legislature, whether it's theocratic or not.
See, I think the fact that this is a charter school, like, this isn't putting some religious aspect, whether it's prayer or the Ten Commandments, in a school. This is, the school itself is religious. And it's through the charter school system where they think that's possible. And I think that's a factor here. It might not be the cause. I think you're right that the timing right now, and with what the courts are doing, the timing does suggest that the courts is probably the main cause. But for the way they decided to do this, to try and make an entire public school religious, I don't think that this would be happening were it not for the charter school structure existing.
I reserve my ire for the breach of the separation of church and state. I am equally angered by Texas legislators trying to put Christ in public school classrooms, just as I am angered by the Oklahoma state legislature trying to put public money in a religious institution. I don't have any ire for charter schools themselves. I think they're great.
They should keep Christ where he belongs, in Christmas. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. There's no apostrophe in we're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Let's get ready to ruble, said Justin. Only recently found out that the Russians have a head mercenary. Let me blow your mind and tell you that there are 7 mercenary armies run by cronies of Putin in Ukraine currently. Wagner is the most famous, run by career criminal turned hot dog vendor turned caterer turned state-sponsored warlord Evgeny Prigozhin. But Patriot PMC is the most prominent outfit, owned by the defense minister Sergei Shoigu. Those folks are better equipped and generally more combat veterans before joining. Gazprom, the state-owned energy company, provided multiple units to the fight in order to protect their oil interests. It makes the invasion of Iraq look subtle in comparison. When Putin took power in 2000, he was worried that he would be deposed by an upcoming military hero. So he fired 40% of the upper ranks and replaced them with loyal lackeys, then shut down most of the military academies. So essentially, the Russian army is a bunch of companies all competing against each other to try to get more money from Putin. You get results, you get a dacha. You fail, you get a ticket to Serbia. If you want to see cutthroat politics, Russia is Game of Thrones, House of Cards, Succession, and MASH in one place. I didn't know any of that, nor do I know if it's true, but I'm going to assume that it is. Did you guys know any of that?
I did not.
I only knew about the one mercenary group, but I can't say I'm surprised by it. So much of wars have been privatized, so of course Russia's in that game.
Yeah, so Wagner's the one that's gotten the most attention because they were openly recruiting criminals. They were going to prisons and saying, hey, we'll let you out if you fight, but if you run, we'll kill you.
I'll say that the Putin description there rings true to me. I mean, that is a properly cronyist regime where you're getting credit for loyalty to the crown, not through competency. It's one of the reasons that they've had a lot of difficulty in prosecuting the war effort as quickly as they thought they were going to do, because you look up and down the chain of command and there's very little incentive to report when things are bad. There's very good incentive to show how awesome your group is. So authoritarian regimes tend to have a difficult time actually seeing how good their military is because nobody will give them the straight answer.
We are not so different, you and I, right? Heaton loves the no labels party idea. It's a spoiler party backed by billionaires. It's no different than the other two parties. Answer the man.
Justin, may I ask, because I know that you very kindly cut down the emails we get to save on time and rancor. Was there more context to this that will make me less caustic in my response?
Nope.
Okay, in that case, listener, ha-ha, you fool! I've never been a populist labor Democrat. I have not. That is not the thing that I was. My problem, listener, has always been with having this dichotomous binary thinking where everything in the world is red team versus blue team, and further, building entire governmental edifices on top of that, where all of us are forced to participate in red team versus blue team. The people don't get to pick their candidates. The people don't get multiple options. They get two options. One more option than you get in a totalitarian regime. Just two options, right? That's the problem that I've had. Anybody that wants to try to buck that system, anybody that wants to try to rip apart the duopoly and have actual competition of ideas and policies and the American experience that we get to vote on, I will support them. So if the socialists want to come in or the American Communist Party wants to come in and support ranked choice voting or open primaries, I will stand arm to arm with them. And in the meantime, no labels, great. Keep fucking pissing off the Republicans and Democrats.
Boom.
If only the Republican and Democratic Party had more money and influence and media coverage. I think that's the problem. That's what's unfair is that this no labels party is just hogging all the money and media coverage. Mm. Will someone think of the billionaires' rights? I couldn't disagree more with Briney and Heaton about finding more ways to make the quote unquote wealthy pay more tax. Like the debt we've normalized, the federal budget should be infinity. Every crisis, every issue requires more spending. There's no financial accountability. And when our economy takes a nosedive, we'll be weighing more money instead of counting it. Jonah Norberg has a video where he talks about this. Once you have a significant portion of the population divorced from the economic realities of budget and taxation, you're looking at the rich checking the fuck out and going somewhere else. And frankly, I wouldn't blame them for doing so.
No one is arguing for the budget to be infinity. I mean, that's just such an exaggeration that I don't even know how to take it seriously. Like, we've done some mass. So I'm doing an episode right now on the whole debt bill and how it did absolutely nothing about the debt. And so I looked into where did the debt come from, and the tax cuts were a major part of it. Like, when you go and you look at what the projections were for what our debt was going to be, we actually could afford it. Things were going to rise with inflation, but like our debt was relatively under control until we cut massive taxes, mainly for the wealthy. So when you want to, if you want to be serious about government spending and debt, you have to take revenues into account. And there is a segment of us that can certainly afford it. So to afford to be taxed more, it's not the lower class, it's not the middle class, it is the upper class. And so if you actually give a shit about the debt, that has to be a part of the conversation, because the idea that we're just spending wildly and that it's just not, it's not true. So there you go.
Heaton, have you ever heard of this national debt thing?
Yeah. Yes, I have. Actually, I just did a very, very big episode of this 2 weeks ago that talks about when the debtpocalypse is going to smack us upside the head and all of the frenzy that will occur. So, listener, I suspect that you are kind of instinctively reacting against the soak the rich position, which is a very common trope within the United States of, you know, the people are poor because rich people are rich, they're evil. I'm very much in agreement with you there that just the idea that we should like pulp billionaires to punish them and take money out is a bad way of approaching economics and governance. If you remember the episode we did last week, though, I made a division between an ethical stance on progressive taxes versus just prudential application thereof. The ethical stance that I took, which I stand by, is if we got to raise taxes to pay for something, generally speaking, progressive tax rates make more sense to me because there are people that are going to feel the pinch of that less. The prudential side of it, which you bring up and I don't disagree with you on, is, you know, kind of a laffer curve for billionaires. And you're right about that. I also mentioned this last week that the wealth tax had been implemented in 15 European countries and 13 of them have now abandoned them. That Norway increased its wealth tax last year, it increased its income tax on the wealthy and more left in the last year than they had in the previous 10 years combined. Those are very, very applicable things. And I don't disagree with you on the application of that. And as far as the debt goes, I do think we are spending wildly. I think we're spending more than we can. We need to cut back on the amount of spending that we're going to do, but that's probably going to require higher taxes too. All of the research I've done indicates that we probably need to do some combination of tax increases and spending cuts. The model that I prefer is $2 of spending cuts for every dollar of tax increase. If you can figure out how to do that through getting rid of loopholes, great. I would love to just stick it there. If not, it's probably going to require having it be on the higher end of the progressive income distribution than the lower end. So I don't think that being fiscally prudent is something that means that you can't ever tax rich people. The position that I take is, generally speaking, if it's worth paying for, it's worth taxing people for. We ought to have a debate about whether it's worth spending on in the first place. But then once we do that, the thing that I'm primarily concerned with is the debt to GDP ratio. How big is our debt in proportion to our economy? We need it to be shrinking in proportion to our economy rather than growing. And the only two ways to do that, three ways, are grow the economy, cut spending, or increase taxes. And I want to do all three of those things to get us into a good spot.
Answer the question, writes, is Andrew your relator, Jen your maven, and Justin your evangelist? Jen.
I don't know what that means.
Keaton.
Yeah, probably. That was so last week, I just mentioned the debt episode I did a fortnight ago, which was really, really intense. 2-hour monologue episode, really heavily produced, heavily researched. The following week, I wanted to do something that was fun and a little bit more, dare I say, horoscopy, which was looking at personality types in politics. And I brought on a friend of mine that wrote a book that I really enjoyed, Bijoy Goswami. And we talked about this kind of model he's come up with where there are people that are knowledge-based people, people that are interrelational people, and folks that are kind of evangelists, getting other people excited and building movements. And I think your description of Jen, myself, and Justin's probably correct. Who got us to do this? Justin. Justin's the one that is leading this. Justin's the one that's driving it. And Justin's the one that convinced me and Jen to do it. So I'd say he's definitely our evangelist. And then I think Jen and I are probably pretty balanced when it comes to maven relator. Maybe I'm a bit more relator. She's a bit more maven. But I think we're probably...
What the hell does that mean?
Yeah, I don't know what it means.
Listen to my goddamn episode. It's on the political orphanage last
week. No, you can't make me.
Summarize it.
You're not my dad.
Okay, so a brief summary here. If you are, according to Bijoy, and I think that this is a fun model, all models are wrong, some models are useful, this is useful in certain contexts, you find that when people are collaborating on projects in business or politics or podcasts, that there tend to be three different nodes of personality attributes that people have, kind of their primary driver. Some people are really driven by knowledge. This would be like your friend that knows everything about every movie. When you talk to him about Jurassic Park, he can bring up the cinematographer and he knows what kind of film they were using. People that really, really enjoy knowing stuff. There are people that enjoy,
like somebody who would be out in the woods and spent hours looking up judicial history, yes, so they could look smart on a podcast.
Okay. Yeah, something something like that. Although, to my credit,
and which
Justin,
one's that? Which one's that? Which one's that?
That one would be a later? Maven. A maven is, but
a maven. Okay.
At the same time, somebody that's reading through congressional bills and knows the ins and out of the congressional bills might fall into that category as well. Second category is relater. This is somebody that really enjoys interpersonal relationships. This is the person at the party who's looking around and like goes up and is like, hey, Jeremy doesn't seem like he's talking. We should go talk to Jeremy. The person that's really, really doing that. Lobbyists would be good relators, whereas like a policy wonk would be a maven. And then an evangelist is somebody that is very action driven, very excited, wants other people to be excited and tends to build movements. So like I would say Elizabeth Warren is more of a maven. Obama is more of an evangelist. Bill Clinton's more of a relator. Just use a bunch of Democrats there. And so that's what we played on the Political Orphanage last week. And I appreciate the listener trying to put us into that.
No, then this is wrong. This is wrong. Okay. Andrew's the maven and Jen is the relator, because Jen is far more of a connection to the people. And the whole premise of her show is that this is what the government is doing without your knowledge and the media is not covering it. And you have a connection to the people in a way that I don't think either Andrew or I do, but I'm definitely the horseshit carnival barker. So you nailed it. One out of three. You got it.
Yeah.
And I do forget facts right after I write them down and say them. So I'm not an encyclopedia of anything, just naturally in my brain. I need my notebook with me at all times. So I'll put me in relator as well.
Yeah, maybe I am the maven. All that court stuff I brought up was from a year ago when I did a judicial episode on the Political Orphanage. So maybe I'm the maven.
You're the maven. You're the maven. That's so maven.
You pulled legal shit right out of your ass while in the woods. Like, I can't do that.
Will somebody think of the expats rights? As a former expat, there was one tax thing that always got me thinking, and I'm always surprised that it's not spoken about much. Taxing U.S. citizens who live and work in other countries. The U.S. began taxing its citizen internationally during the Civil War in order to pay for that war, and like all wartime taxes and most policies, this stuck around and never went away despite its unpopularity.
So I actually looked into this because obviously I wanted to live outside the country, and you're right that we do double taxation, but you can get your taxes waived on the first, I think it's $250,000 of your income, as long as you're not in the United States for about 11 months out of the year. So, and for most of us, that covers most of our federal taxes. So unless you're super wealthy, you actually kind of don't have to pay taxes here unless you really aren't an expat.
I think that this person has a good point, and I'm going to double up on him. First of all, if they're outside of the country, they're not getting goods and services from the United States. So I don't think we should just bilk people for extra money if they're particularly successful and they're not actually living here. Tina Turner, decent example of that. But listener, the bit that I'll add to that I think that the system gets particularly bad is with a thing called FATCA. Being a former expat, you might be familiar with this. People listening probably aren't, because this is a bit in the weeds on international tax policy. About 2012 or so, Chuck Schumer got this passed. FATCA is an attempt to stop tax avoidance from Americans abroad that are that make over the $250,000 limit that Jen alluded to. And it sounds great because, you know, people going to, you know, keeping their money offshore, .. I have met some really heartbroken people that this is directly affected that didn't do a goddamn thing to deserve this. There's a lady from Oklahoma that I met who lives in Canada. She is a public school teacher, and she makes $35,000 a year, maybe a little bit more. I don't remember the exact feature. And her husband makes $230,000 a year. They live in Canada. They pay Canadian taxes. They have to pay Canadian taxes, mind you. They don't get to pick whether they're paying American or Canadian taxes. They have to pay Canadian taxes because they live in Canada. FATCA got passed, and now all of a sudden, her income, her husband's income, a man who's never lived in the United States because he's Canadian, he's married to an American woman. Their entire income is now subject to American taxation. She is an American citizen living in Canada making $35,000 a year. But according to Uncle Sam, their household is earning $250,000, and they have to pay American taxes and Canadian taxes. What did this poor lady do? She had to go to a court in Canada and, sobbing, renounce her American citizenship because it was the only way not to cripple her family economically. There are a lot of problems like that. I think FATCA really screwed over a lot of people in situations like that that can't afford to pay taxes in two different countries and shouldn't, because, again, that guy's Canadian. There's no reason he should be paying taxes to America. But in an attempt to stop the evil billionaires, we ended up screwing over a bunch of middle class people that were minding their own business.
Civic Checkpoint brings us home. When is the last time each of you contacted one of your district's congressional members, and what issues did you raise, Jen?
I mean, I have my representatives saved in my phone, so I call them kind of often. I think the last time was after I did my train derailment episode, and I called all three of them and left a message about not letting train companies regulate themselves, something like that. I can't remember the exact wording. It was a month ago, but yeah, I do it fairly regularly.
The last time that I did it, I believe, was when I was still living in Florida. I called Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was then my representative. And she, I believe it was about either like FOSFA or SESTA, like one of the big internet things that all the internet people were getting internet mad about. I called to register my point of view on that. Eaton?
I can't remember the last time I called my representative to register. Maybe 2010, I think, might have been the last time.
What?
Keep in mind, I worked for Congress.
He's got PTSD.
As somebody in constituent relations. So I've been in that room, and I've seen the impact those phone calls have, or the lack thereof. And so I'm not terribly inclined to do it. That said, I called my state representative and my state senator 2 months ago. And I suspect that probably has more impact. There was a bill circulating in the House in Texas to prohibit any municipality from engaging in ranked choice voting. The one-party rule state of Texas does not like anybody stepping out of that binary we were talking about earlier, and they're trying to double down on that to stop, you know, legitimate democracy from ever flourishing in the great state of Texas. So I called my state rep and my state senator, and I think it was actually much better for me to do that. I was able to have, you know, 10, 15-minute conversations with their staff. Their staffs are smaller. They have less things going on. They have less constituents they're dealing with. I suspect that had more outsized impact. But yeah, I might be shitty for it. I haven't called my congressman to register an opinion in a long time because I don't think that I don't think it makes a huge difference when I do it.
So that goes against everything I've heard from the staffers I've met and from Jack Abramoff. They all said it makes a difference. Like, your one call might not make a difference, but they do tally whether people are on one side of an issue or another. And he said that so few people call that, you know, especially if it's an issue that's not, you know, the issue that's clogging the phones, if it's something kind of random, it can make a difference. I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that you don't think it does, because it goes against everything I've heard over the last 10 years.
So my experience was that phone calls were really a conduit to one specific voting demographic, which were unemployed and retired people. Not everybody calling in is unemployed or retired, obviously, but I would say probably 90 to 95% of phone calls made to a congressional office, at least while I was there, are them. So the representatives, while they're not dismissing it, recognize that the phone calls are not emblematic of the overall constituency. They're one way of seeing one group of people in the constituency. My experience was that the congressman had some issues that their mind was made up on, and they were not going to be registering. They weren't going to be changing their mind based on what the district said. Things like whether they're pro-choice or pro-life, things like that, where they're just going into it, they're like, this is what you get. There were some issues that they were very open on that, where, you know, if a bunch of people called in and they had strong thoughts on the Lilly Ledbetter Act, the congressman would go, okay, you know, I don't really care one way or the other. If a bunch of my constituents want the Lilly Ledbetter Act, I'll sign it or I'll vote on it. And then there were certain things where the congressman was keeping a tally. I wouldn't say that was everything, but there were some things that he was keeping a tally on. I was in a moderate Democrat office during Obamacare, and Tim did not reveal how he was going to vote until the day of. And so he did want to know what the people were doing it. Again, it wasn't like a proper poll, but it was a kind of way of looking at it. You know what? It might be an effective thing to do. Justin, you probably hit the nail on the head. I've been screamed at by so many angry people. I've probably been screamed at by over 1,000 people during that 1 year that I was there. And I mean screamed at, that I have a little bit emotional disconnect now from calling congressional offices. So it could just be baggage on my end.
Yeah, because like I feel like there's a way to do it too. Like I'm always so nice to the staffers and I try to like, if they actually answer the phone, I ask their names and like, you know, I'm nice to them. And I think that makes a big difference. I don't think the screaming method works.
That absolutely does. 100%. I can tell you, like, there was this one pharmacist from Eastern Oklahoma. I don't imagine he's listening, but he would call once every couple of weeks and I would like let him talk to me for half an hour because he was a nice guy. and it was such a nice reprieve. Because most of the people I was hearing from were the aforementioned demographic right after either Glenn Beck or some other bomb thrower got off the air. It was all like I could, the phone calls would come in waves depending on the Fox programming. And, you know, I would dutifully do my job and write down their stuff. I always executed the position of my office's constituent liaison. But in terms of any impact it made on me or things that I might want to verbally represent to the congressman, the people that were nice and thoughtful had far more impact and far more registry than just somebody screaming. I would write down whatever they did, but it wouldn't emotionally resonate with me, and I would dislike them profoundly.
Are you or someone you know a Hill staffer currently? Please email werenotwrongpod@gmail.com and tell us whether or not any of this shit matters. And if it doesn't, what the best way that you can interact with our representatives in federal government. Again, werenotwrongpod@gmail.com. There's no apostrophe in werenotwrongpod@gmail.com.
Hey, Justin.
Because we're not wrong. Yes.
I'm interrupting you. When I did my meetup in D.C. here about 3 weeks ago, I made a new staffer friend. There's a staffer that listens to the show, and he's written into us a few times, and he came out there. It was great. We hung out in front of the TuneIn, and I was just devouring his knowledge, going, what happens now? Like, what's it like? And I was explaining my old-timer stuff, and he was giving me a rundown. It was really cool. I'm going to hit him up next time I'm in town.
Well, then he needs to write in, or she. Your anonymity will be guaranteed. Mm-hmm. Write in werenotwrongpod@gmail.com.
Justin, should we be calling it werenotwrongpod@gmail.com?
I don't give a shit. I don't give a shit about these pendants. Look, no one's ever put a fucking apostrophe in an email ever. I've been on the internet for 30 fucking years and no one's ever done it. No one's starting now. Like, enough. It's where not wrong. There's no apostrophe. All right. Apostrophes are banned. Far as I'm concerned, and cancel Christmas. We're Not Wrong Pod is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. I'm going first on the plugs. We have a bunch of announcements, folks. The Republican National Convention's nominee will be one of the people that have announced over the last few months, and that includes Chris Christie and Mike Pence. We have breakdowns. Oh, and Doug Burgum. There's always a person that you don't know that makes themselves a little mini star. And Doug Burgum of one of the Dakotas, I honestly forgot, is now running in his campaign ad. He said, woke used to be a thing you did at 5 a.m. to start work. And also starts with the most unhinged few lines. There's no second chance at a first impression. In his debut video, he just starts with, my dad died when I was 16. There we go. That's the opener. Vote for me for president. PX3, politics, 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 where all your podcasts are found. Heaton, what you got cooking?
I reached out to somebody involved with animal rights because I was curious as to what the rights are that govern livestock and how they're slaughtered in the United States. It is a topic that directly pertains to me, given how much food I eat on a regular basis and how much of that is composed of beef and chicken. But I don't really know. And I started kind of thinking about it because I went, you know, I'm opposed to dog fights. I would outlaw dog fighting. Are there thresholds of anti-suffering that we put into how we raise livestock or how we slaughter livestock? What are they? What would be better? And brought on this guy. I thought he was a great chat. For anybody that's worried about it, there's no part of this that turns into like a weird, preachy, crusade or anything like that, but he actually did convince me to give up one type of meat. I have one less meat in my diet after this conversation. So if you're interested in the intersection of law and animal suffering, check out The Political Orphanage this week. And if that sounds horrible to you, go back a year and check out some of the Judge Week stuff that I did on Kennedy v. Bremerton and all of that stuff if you like court cases involving separation of church and state.
Cool beans, Jen Briney.
I read the debt ceiling bill, so I'm telling people what's in it as opposed to who won and all that bullshit, because I can tell you all of the stuff I've heard about the debt ceiling bill did not prepare me for what was actually in the debt ceiling bill. I can tell you the animals have problematic provisions in the debt ceiling bill. So I'll talk all about that, and then we'll talk about the debt in general. Yeah, I'm going to be angry in this episode. Just if you like angry Jen, you'll like this episode. And if you don't, well, you won't. So, yeah, that's what I am recording this week.
There we go. And that wraps it up for us on our regular episode. If you're a patron, you get one more topic. You could start it right now instead of this lonely, cold goodbye. Because for Jen Briney, Andrew Heaton, I'm Justin Robert Young. And we're not wrong.
Apostrophe.
No, there's no fucking apostrophes.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.